panel, I was in Wagga Wagga collecting the data from regional groups to get that aspect of African settlement. So I thought today, look, I'll show you, and it's not a complete work, but just some insights into what I'm doing in regional rural Australia. In this case, Wagga. So why regional rural focus? Meredith said in the morning that the government decided that people were clustering so much in metropolitan Sydney and Melbourne, that there's this encouragement of people settling as skilled migrants and humanitarian settlers to move into regional rural areas. There's also been a prevalence in public discourses of Africans' inability to settle, and so that is also important. If people in urban areas are being questioned on their settlement, what is happening in regional rural area where there's prevalence of white people? A case in point was the Tamworth case when in 2006, Tamworth, which is a town located in the northern part of New South Wales, was going to receive people from Africa. And then around that time, there's usually a festival in Tamworth, which is the music festival in Blues. I'm not really familiar with that, but there's a festival. And incidentally, the questioning of African settlement coincided with that festival. So instead of Tamworth being recognized for a wonderful festival to celebrate art, we were questioning Africans' ability to settle. And this was actually captured in this very interesting caricature by Kathy Wilcox. The Australian National Museum collects cartoons that have gone on in the year as part of collecting and recognizing political history of the country. So this has made it into the museum, and it captures what happened around that time. For me, what is interesting is that even when we're caricatured and captured in caricature, we don't get it right. Line 4 says, they told me I ain't white enough. Being an African person or someone from that background, I can identify that diction coming from black African or African-American lingua, not typically African. So where is Wagga? What I found really interesting with Wagga too is that Wagga is down southwest of Sydney, and it's quite equidistant from Tamworth. It's equidistant to Sydney as Tamworth is from to Sydney, so it's quite interesting. It is close to the Victorian New South Wales border, and it has a population of 57,439, as noted in the 2006 census, which is pushing close or even beyond 60,000 as we speak now. The majority of people in Wagga are white, Australian-born, which makes almost 90% of people. And then community language other than English-speaking backgrounds make 3.5% of the population. I prefer the term community language other than English, which is not as derogatory as non-English-speaking, non-native English-speaking backgrounds, because as every pillar will have. who is the native speaker? That is quite contentious here. And this is just to give an idea of the area we're talking about. When I sat there listening this morning, we all have heard how social inclusion is founded on factors like employment, to give you social economic status and social capital. So I thought it really good to have a look at the industries in the mainly white occupied occupations, and except for maybe construction and manufacturing, maybe, because there's an abattoir in Wagga. So this is just to give you an idea of the industries in there. WADA has a history of receiving and supporting families from humanitarian backgrounds. And Kwame said this morning about Christianity and how Christians have helped people and people settle. Well, the Start Easy Go project was started by Catholics in the area, and they looked to help humanitarians initially from Laos in 1978 to settle, and the first Africans to be settled by San Isidore Project came in 1991 from Angola. And then in 1994, another African family came in there. So what are some of the reasons for settlement? I already mentioned that the government would encourage people to settle there so that there's no, eases some of the density in places like Melbourne and Sydney. But also we see chain migration. People go in there, like the place, and encourage their families to come and join them and settle there. And also, there's this form of secondary settlement where people have settled in urban areas and then decided to move to more quiet locations for the sake of their children's learning. So how do I put these all these together? I have two questions that I use to kind of help me stay on track and put this paper together. My questions are, how do Africans as L2 learners and users in a rural, regional setting construct individual and collective selves as they negotiate systemic structures for inclusion? Which simply means, what do these people say? You want a perspective of the people who are settling, a deviation from the normal top-down approach, bottom-up. What are we doing? If I'm doing language learning for settlement on wisdom for Africans, what are Africans saying, and how can I say it the way Africans will understand or will recognize it as being said by an African, not to be essential. Essentialist, because I kind of, yeah. So how does, and the second question is, how does L2 proficiency mitigate access to social networks or social capital for inclusion? To answer these questions, well, I did field work in WADA. I went with my son. It was important for me to go with my son, and I will show you why at the end of my paper. So I went with my son from 15th to 25th of September. I didn't know anyone in WADA. I just wanted to go as an anthropologist and see how I could create rapport with people who didn't know me and see if I could get their stories, get them to confide in me what their stories are so I can tell it for them. So I recruited participants through the Adult Migrants English Program, and once again, Loy has explained how Adult Migrants English Program is found in various parts of the country. And then there were people who were recruited through people I found there. And then I had informal conversations with WAFRICA members. WAFRICA is an African community group that has been formed, so that people are organizing, because the numbers are so little, they need to organize so that their voices will be heard by the government. There needs to be some sort of recognition, and service providers, and also significant others. So this is just my participants, 15 male, female and 8 male, and their arrival range from 2003 to 2008. And I didn't specifically go to one community, I just spoke to anyone who was interested in being part of this research. These are the countries that they came from. So narrating hybrid lives, what are some of the contradictions and complexities that will come out of the data that I collected from the people themselves? What are they saying in terms of employment? Because employment is the main thing, even though there are other factors. I think employment seems to be the main salient things when it comes to social inclusion and economic capital. So Sylvia says, I want to work, I want my own money. And Timothy says, we need a job, but it's difficult for us. And Kate also says, getting a job in WADA is the biggest thing. All these names are pseudonyms. We'll now look at the story of Sylvia. Sylvia came from Sudan in 2005. She came from Kakuma camp, and she has six children. She came with her husband, and she said to me, he's not my husband, he's someone we got our children. So the concept of husband and wife is also quite different, but they have their children. They're now not husband and wife anymore. this she did have 510 hours in the NEP, and she hasn't got a job. So I asked about what is she doing. She says, I felt like I should do a course because all my papers were not recognized. Instead of doing English class, I could be given something to do, a course or something which will help me to get work here. And so I asked, you were being given Centrelink money, because this is the government social welfare money that is given to help people settle. And in the public discourses, what we all hear is that African people do not want work. They're rotting the system, they're dull bludgers, they just want the government's money. And that is the uproar that you hear from all angles in here. So I said, well, you were being given Centrelink money. And she said, yeah. So what? You know, and then she says, and then I said, you don't think that was enough? Because I wanted her point of view in terms of that money to help them. And she says, Centrelink money? So she answers my question with a question. Are you asking me about Centrelink money? You think that is all I want? So I said, yes. And then she said, you know very well in Africa, you want to work for yourself. This is something drawing on a common ground of our Africanness, appealing to me as an African. You know that you want to work. You are an African. She positions herself as someone who wants work, who wants to settle. But it is not so. Not because of her doing, but because of structures and things that are making it impossible for her to work. I don't like Centrelink money because I don't like it because the money is like a threat. You take the money, then later just following it. Every time you are following, what you are doing, I want to work. I want my own money. I'll be happy with my work. I'll be happy enjoying my money. Nobody will be stop me with what I'm doing. And yeah, I know how. Yeah, it is hard. So you get this situation where she's unable to work. She can't do anything about it. She's been giving Centrelink money. She's not saying it's not good, but it is not sufficient, and so she wants to work. But on the other hand, she doesn't have the capital, the social capital to get into work. So I said, well, when you finish your 510 hours, did you start doing the course? Because she wanted, instead of doing the 510, to be doing a course. So I said, well, did you start the course? And she said, yes, she started the course in community welfare, because when she was in Kakuma, she worked with helping people, counseling girls, and helping them live in the camp. So she wanted something similar. But she started doing certificate 4, so, and I didn't actually complete it because it was very confusing. Yeah, I've been doing, because I was a community. So you see that sometimes she's unable to express when she gets confused and not knowing the complexity that she's dealing with in terms of what she wants to do and how her hands are tied and even her tongue gets tied when it comes to those sections. And then when I offered work out for community, she said, yeah, just be like in the community and the way we do things in the camp, because I didn't work in my country. I just tried to, that is what we do in the camp. So she's got skills in the camp, but it's not recognized because they're not formal skills that she can translate into social capital and work. I found this really, really interesting and really poignant, because in here we see someone who is not able to work, but then when I entered her house to interview her, there was a lady, a young girl sitting in her lounge room, so I thought that was one of her daughters. So I mentioned about her daughter, and she said, no, that's not my daughter. That is someone I found on the street and brought home. And I said, okay. And she said, she can't stay here now, and I will show you what happened. So she brings her to the UK, and I said, why did you do that? And she said, it's just I'm bringing, like, African culture. So you were the one of the elders in the Kakuma camp? She said, yeah. And now that you've come here, you've brought the same culture here, and she said, that is me now. That is me. This is who she feels comfortable being, despite learning English or whatever. She doesn't see herself as doing the formal community work, which is so confusing to her. But she does what she's done all the time and knows how to do this. So, I found the girl, the parents, they have problem with the parents, which I don't know, and actually I don't know what I can say. So she don't have a great deal at the moment. We talk with dogs, with police, with everything, and now she's living here for a while, then her case will be sorted out with the parents when don't they want to take it. I didn't change anything in there, I just wanted to show how she spoke and all her wonderful English. So what struck me with this story here is we see someone who needs English to settle. She has basic life skills in helping people in the community in Kakuma. She lived there all her life, had her children there. Normally when we hear about people, I avoid using the word refugee. When we hear about people from humanitarian backgrounds, we tend to see them as villains or victims or people who are expelled on Australian land. But this is someone who, despite their inability to stay in the classroom and to do the formal literacy in a certificate in welfare, has taken the initiative to use her skills to access something that will be elusive to her to settle. There's more room for interpretation depending on how you see it. But I found that really, really interesting. As I'm running out of time, I'll just go to the next story. And this is from a young man. He turned 30 the day after I went to interview him. And he migrated he's from Sudan. And he came with his wife in 2006. And he's in level 2 English and his wife is in level 4 English. So it was really hard to get to interview him because he had a job. And I was really surprised because everyone that had a job that I wasn't able to interview them worked in the abattoir. But he didn't work in the abattoir. So when I went to interview him, I asked him, how did you get a job? How did you get to work? And he said, I have my neighbor from, and he said, Australian one. And I said, Australian neighbors? He said, yeah, because he's supervisor, okay? And yeah, and then one day I stay here and then he asked me, he said, why are you? You Africa. You stay at home and you receive money from Centrelink. You don't want the job? I tell him no, because not like that. We need a job. But here it's difficult for us because we are some people put application and then they tell me, call you back and nothing. If you apply for the job in the abattoir, which is the name I've deleted, they call you immediately. Why? And then he said, it is not like this for us. And then he go. The next day he came. And he said, here is Paul, take it. And then I take it. And then we'll take you. Yeah, then I fill the form. And then they come after 3 days and tell me tomorrow interview. And I went to the interview. And I was like, wow. And he said, yeah. So how did you feel at the interview? Were you able to understand when they asked the question? And what did you say? Yeah, I understand, because the first time I tell him, I say sorry, because my English is not perfect. If something I didn't understand, I just ask. He said, no worries, because we have Indian here working with us. He don't know English, and then we start interview. Yeah, so what sort of job is this? It's a spare parts car shop. They work with spare parts. And in fact, the place is so noisy because I went to do research in there to see if I could capture some of his interaction with his peers. But it's so noisy, we had to put in earplugs. So he's doing so well at this company because someone gave him a chance, because someone actually listened, because there was a dialogue that went on. So, yeah. Still on Sudanese, and I still chose Sudan because of all the people about Sudanese, I'm not saying Sudanese and this and that. This is a proverb from the Sudanese community. It's from Mali. Mali is one of the languages, and it says, Nyali, which is where I got, and this was another person who I asked about jobs, and he's, when he was in the camp, he used to help other people, and now he's here, his hands are tied, he's not able to get a job. And he says, your riches, your wealth are in your deal. So you have this discourse of people wanting to work, but not being given the opportunity. And when opportunities are there, it is what you're being funneled into, whether you like it or not. And if you don't take it up, then you don't want to work, and you're lazy. And therefore, your inclusion will be problematic. Okay, so what are some of the implications that I've drawn in here? I know I've only got 1 minute. Okay. So, yeah, these are some of the implications for social inclusion that I've kind of teased out, but this work is ongoing, and obviously I just came back from work I transcribed and still getting close to my data, so it's not the final thing. And I thought I'll leave everyone with something. When I went to work, I went with my son. My then 12-year-old son, 13-year-old son, came with me to work. This was my own son who, when he was in year 7, came home crying and wanted to be white. It was really heartbreaking for me that he came crying, Mom, I want to be white. I said, no, you can't be white. We're black. This is what we are. But how do you explain to a 7-year-old that you can't be like your friends? And children, we all know, can be very cruel. So it was really hard. One day he came and he said, Mom, I know how to be white. I said, really? He said, yes. What are you going to do? He said, look, he had a little scab on his hand and he was peeling it back. I said, hey, is that how you're going to turn white? He said, yes, of course, it's right underneath. I will peel it back. I said, no. You've got the whole of your lifetime to peel that scab back. You stay black. That is what you are. So we've learned, we've grown, and these are some of the things that keep me going, and the encouragement from everyone in the community, from people in Wagga. They're happy to see a black face, come to talk about them, about things with them, for them, and a woman at that, they couldn't ask for more. So I thought I'll share my son's drawing. After he'd come and been crying, one day he comes with this painting, which was 2007. Since the first time was in 2003, so 4 years after he got to this painting. And so I've carried it with me and I've downloaded it to share with people to see that this is my reality too. It's not like talking about people that I don't know, I haven't experienced it, but I have experienced it. And we're still feeling it. And so, but all is not lost because my son says, good people make a good country. Thank you.
So much. That was lovely, and feels like we should be having a discussion now. But I sort of feel we have to make our way in those terms, and we'll do the same.